Welcome to the Canine Classroom, a podcast for dog training professionals and dog enthusiasts where we discuss training, behavior, and everything in between. We're two friends and dog trainers that share a passion for dogs. We're constantly learning, exploring, and questioning each other's ideas as well as our own so we can become better at what we do. We're here to provide helpful advice, have open conversations, ask questions, get answers, as well as hear from colleagues and experts in the industry, regardless of method and training style. So take a seat and get your notepad out because class is in session.
I still don't remember the name of our podcast. Like, it's so weird to me. Canine Classroom. Yeah, it's kind of silly. Who chose that name?
So, all right. Well, we're back, everyone. What's the name of our podcast, Vinny?
The Classroom of Canines.
Classroom of Canines. We are back. I'm here with that guy, Vinny Viola. I used to say V, but it's Viola.
It's Viola.
I got you there.
Yeah, me messed up. It's like, don't tell me how to say my fucking last name.
Yeah. So, and then I'm Anthony D. What is it?
DeMarinis.
DeMarinis, according to his Siri. Yeah. So, and then today we're here with Aaron Lines, right? Linus.
Just Linus. So we can make sure nobody's name is pronounced correctly. Yes, it's Linus.
Linus.
That's way better than Lines.
So tell us a little about yourself and remind me where in Canada you are. I forget.
Yeah, so I'm in Quesnel, BC, which is in the interior part of British Columbia on the West Coast, sort of a smaller, more remote-ish area, not very urbanized here. I've got a dog training facility, the Aramet Air Academy, where I train dog diving in the summer, as well as agility and shed antler hunting and some retriever work and stuff like that. I also teach online for the Fenzi Dog Sports Academy, and I breed labs. So I've got the Aramet Labrador Retrievers as well.
And your labs are working line or field bred, correct?
Yeah, they're primarily field lines, and they do all sorts of things. So most of our puppies end up going to homes that are either like really sporty pet people or really serious competitors in agility, dog diving, obedience, and lots of them go to homes in search and rescue as well. So they're busy out there. Yeah.
Julie Simons, who you know from Fenzi, she is one of the people who coaches me and knows work. And when I was up there, I don't know, like 4 months ago or so, she was set, because she's like 5 hours from me. So she was saying that she does come across your dogs quite often.
Yeah, there's a growing number of them doing nose work too. And I know lots of my puppy people like to train with Julie. So she's probably got a pretty good little crew of Labrador sniffers there. Yeah.
That's what she said. Yeah. Your dogs look so cool. Like, I just sit there like, it's so fucking ridiculous. I'll just sit there and watch your little like Labrador puppies do it, because you just post so many funny videos. I'll just sit there all day and scroll through them and like, I don't remember that red one's name, but I wanted to fucking come over there and just take that son of a bitch home. Like that one. Oh my God.
You could have taken him after agility class on Monday. He was rotten.
Yes. I love him already.
Just take your time, Anthony.
But how old is that one? Is that the same one that I'm thinking of from a few months ago?
Maybe it's like an adult. I've got Marlon. He's the kind of dark red guy.
Yeah, it was a red one.
Yeah.
I know. I don't know why. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is about the red ones. Like I were the first like working line dog I ever worked with was this red field Labrador who failed his hunting stuff because he just wanted to play with the dogs out of it. Like they used to bring them in the canoe with them. And so he would always jump out of the canoe to go chase like the other dogs. So like he failed, and then he got placed in a home in the suburbs, and it was just like not the right home for him. Like they did everything with him, but he wanted to be on a field running around. And I don't know what it was, but working with that dog, I always said after that, like, I want a red Labrador so bad. Like, I just find them so like good looking, and I don't know, I just find them to be really cool.
They're easy on the eyes, that's for sure.
Don't let them fool you, Zay. Don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, Anthony, come on by. Come take them
Come get this red devil.
now. So yeah, I guess I kind of like one of the things I was curious because I do like follow your stuff a lot, and I find your dogs cool. Oh, and I want to talk about like the sledding thing, by the way, but
For
because that
sure.
I have a lot of questions on. But how did you get into breeding, and yeah, how'd you get into breeding, like especially the field bred and all that stuff?
So I guess I kind of came by it naturally. My family raised labs when I was young. So I grew up with there was, litters of puppies every year and stuff. So my dad had a breeding program, and when he started to kind of phase out of breeding, I got interested and I got my own first lab all for myself and started breeding. That was way back in 1997 already. So almost all of my current dogs descend from that first one that I procured. And we always did hunting when we were growing up in our family. I lived in the prairies in Saskatchewan, and it's a major hunting area for ducks and geese and stuff like that. And everybody did that. All the kids learned when they were like 9 or 10 to go hunting. So hunting with labs was just kind of a thing that we did. And that's the type of lab that I was most interested in. Nowadays, I do have a few of my dogs that have some show lines in there, just a little bit of genetic diversity, and they're kind of growing on me a little bit with the two that I have right now are very smart and hilarious. But generally, most of the things we do with our dogs require quite a bit of athleticism. So the field lines, that's where it's at for them.
And then like so where you live, is that like the woods and stuff? I know I texted you this the other day. That's your property, like where you do all like the outdoor stuff with them?
Yeah, so where I live now is almost opposite of where I grew up, and it's kind of mountains and woods and lots of like you could hike for a million miles on a different trail every day and never see another person. There's just lots of options that way, but we don't have a lot of fields and flyways and that sort of thing. So where you've seen my videos, Anthony, that's mostly in my yard or my surrounded community where I can go hiking and training and stuff.
Jealous.
Yeah.
I'm so jealous. I'm just gonna invite myself so I could come play with
It's
the dog in the woods.
if you were a dog, this is kind of where you want to live. You can go hiking every day, you can do all the things. There's no reason to be on leash except if we have to go do like dog sport stuff. So they get trained for it, but they don't need to be on a leash on their daily life.
So what like how did you like I know you're saying like the hunting stuff kind of is where you started, and then where did it kind of go from there and develop, because obviously like you do a lot of stuff with Fenzie Dog Sports, and you do
Yeah.
a, like not you do actually a variety of things, like it's not like you just focus on one sport.
Yeah, I do all the things, and it's part of that is like sort of the climate in the area. It's not a big population, so dog sport stuff sort of ends up going seasonally. We don't have a big indoor area to train like agility and stuff in the winter. So in the winter we switch to dog sledding, and then in the spring we're shed antler hunting. In the summer we're, back to agility and dock diving and that sort of thing. So part of the interest in all the different sports is just logistical, practical reasons, but also I have labs and they like everything and they're good at everything. And why not try it all? And I don't know, I self-diagnosed ADD or something because it's like you just get really interested in something. You're like, you know what's cool? I should take up this other sport.
You know,
So,
it's so funny that you say that.
yeah.
Like all the sports I've done or participate in, I never really did research on it. Like I was just like, oh, that looks kind of cool, and I just kind of jumped into it. I mean, like even Vinny knows, like I just recently started jiu-jitsu. Like aside from maybe a few videos that Vinny has sent me and messages that like we'll laugh about or talk about, I really never paid attention to it very much. Like I don't like I was at a lesson the other day, and I said to like the coach, I was like, Maybe we should go over the rules because I don't know anything. Like, I haven't even looked into it yet. I'm just like there, like 3 days a week doing it, and I have no fucking clue.
Where are
Like,
we going with this?
there are no rules in the street, Anthony.
So yeah, I mean, like, but I was the same with like sports and stuff. So I just kind of was like, oh, that seems cool. Like, I want to try that and see where it ends up. So yeah, I.
Yeah, for sure. I like that approach. I had a couple of students who had German Shepherds that were coming for dock diving lessons, and they were like, "Well, we're having an IGP trial in a couple of weeks. Maybe you want to come watch." I'm like, "I'll be there. Send me the directions." So I went and watched, and I was like, "You know what? I think a lab do the entry level of this." So we started
See,
training and
I want to
tracking and
do
stuff.
mondeering with a lab, and like I'm
Yeah.
looking for a breeder, so
Well, like, there's
I
when Anthony comes and picks up his red dog, we'll
think
send the puppy home for you.
what
Yeah,
I'll do is I'll wait until the dog's like 6 or 7 months and one of your families like sent it back, like it's just biting everything. I'll be like, just save that one for me.
know what? You're gonna have to fight the Border Patrol because the Canadian Border Patrol emails me like every second week, like, do you have any returned cycle level dogs that we could have for detection? Like, they don't get returned as often as you'd think.
I'll be next in line after them.
Yeah. But I think that would be cool. I think I've seen a couple of labs doing mondioring and stuff in the States. I don't know the people or anything, but I've kind of caught glimpse of them and it looked like they are doing okay. Seemed fun.
Yeah, I've heard of one team, but I'll admit I haven't actually looked into it, but that was my first serious dog was a yellow lab field line. I still have him, obviously, but he's actually the dog I brought to mondeering when I didn't have a Malinois yet, and it was kind of comical and terrible because he just wanted to like run around and pee on everything on the field, like and use his nose. And
Classic
they're looking
Labrador.
at me like, "Your dog needs to be under control." And I'm like, "Oh, well, oops. Next dog, maybe. Maybe the next one."
How is the atmosphere when you show up with a off breed in that sport? Is it are people
I
generally
can't
open to
really
it?
talk about like I can only talk for my sport and then my club. I feel like it's like super open and people like it. At least for me, like I like seeing a dog that's like you wouldn't typically think doing it. I think it's funny. I'm not sure if it's the same in like IGP or like other sports, but I feel like mondeering, at least my outlook on it is like we're fun and goofy and it's like a weird dog carnival. So when there's like, a poodle doing it, it's like, yeah, that's cool. So, but that's me. I'm sure some people might be like, ah, that's not what's supposed to be here,
Get
but I don't
serious.
know. I don't really ever hear, I never really hear that or see
That's
that.
good.
But Anthony might know because he does it with an off-breed dog. So,
I
do you
mean,
ever feel pressured by us or ever
no, you know what?
intimidating
It's
you?
funny. This could be a good conversation, a good topic of conversation, but like, I don't ever feel pressured. And it's funny, I don't ever feel nervous. But what's funny is that I do like my competitive side does kick in. And so it's like, okay, I'm doing this thing with this Kelpie who like half the stuff, like the stuff is arbitrary to her for sure. And then it's like there are little things where her instincts are going to kick in, or it's just more difficult in a way to handle versus like watching everyone else do stuff. And so the competitive side of me gets like pissed because I'm like I know, all right, I know who my dog is. I know that there's a limitation to certain things, and I don't like even I'll get pissed just even saying that because it's like that competitive side, and it's like, oh, but that's a cop out in a way. And then I see like everyone else with their Malinois or their Shepherds, and I'm just kind of like, oh, damn, and I see that, and I'm comparing it to my little like 35-pound Kelpie.
Yeah. It's a thing. It's a thing. I know even when like I'm dog sledding nowadays, I used to race competitively with like purpose-bred Alaskan Huskies. And there's things when you're training a dog that's like purposely bred for a specific sport, you get so many of those behaviors for free that you're training when you've got your off breed. And you can be really proud of all the things you've trained and also still be like, I wish my dog could just do that without having to work so hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it would be like, you bringing one of your dogs to like sheep herding with me. Like, it's just like in my head, I know that, but it's like, well, it's you and your dog, and you're like in the moment, and you're like, damn, like, I wish. Like, why didn't that work? Like, ah, oh, I got like Vinny and I went to workshop together over the summer, and he saw me get so fucking
I
angry.
could tell he was like
Like, I was
angry.
just,
Like
I was
he like
actually.
sat somewhere by himself. It
Oh,
was
no, no,
like
no, no, no. Don't make
it
it
was like,
dramatic,
dude, it
you
was like that
asshole.
meme. It was like that
All
meme where the guy's sitting on the swing set
right.
by himself just staring.
It sounded like I was on the other side of the field. I was like fucking
He
10 feet
left.
from this fucking guy. But yeah, it was
Just
just
bring
like
the box of tissues.
I just sat there quietly. I was just so freaking angry. Just so angry. Anyway.
No, but yeah, I mean, I feel like, and I'm gonna rag on him, but he really changed my life. Like my yellow lab, and we could talk about labs a little bit, obviously, because you breed them. But I felt like as a newer trainer, I was a newer trainer. I didn't know the difference between a field lab and any other type of lab, and I just got this dog, and I was like, man, I must suck. Like I really. Like felt like I was just working uphill battle like the entire time with him. Like everything was so difficult. If I would have like I just wish everyone wishes this, but like I wish I could start over at 6 months old and be like, I know what you are now and like I know how to channel this. But it took me like probably 6 or 7 years before I really understood what made him tick. And then when I then am like a seasoned trainer and I got a dog that was bred for a sport, but like and I was in the sport before I even got the dog because I like knew what I did in the past and I was like, no, like I want the odds stacked in my favor this time. Like what you said is exactly right. Like you get certain things for free. And then because I wasn't fighting this uphill battle, I got to really hone these other things and get good at it versus like trying to work so hard, like just to make like the bare minimum. So
I guess I
yeah,
know that
it's
really well with
yeah, no, like there's some stuff I was like, damn, like I didn't even have like things I spent like years with Baloo, like Zim just like, oh, you just like had it downloaded in your brain somehow. And like I don't even need to and it almost made me have to get creative, like, what am I gonna work on? Like I thought this thing was gonna be this huge issue. You know, like for example, a downstay. Like I probably still to this day, if someone held a gun to my head and was like, you need to get your yellow lab to lay down for a minute on a field with people. Forget, like, I would get a panic attack with Zim. He's just like, oh, you want me to just lay in a position and not move for like 10 hours? Like, okay. Cause he just, that's just how he is. He just like chills. I put him in the yard and Baloo's running around in circles. Zim is laying like a statue, like a gargoyle at the top of the hill. It's just like how he is. And then you're like playing to your strengths. So.
Yeah. And like you said too, Vinny, about your all the trainer skills you've developed in the meantime, some of those things help you just develop a young dog in such a way that you're preventing half the problems anyway. So genetics or no genetics, maybe you weren't going to have this some of those similar problems because of how much more knowledgeable you are. So that part is like, yeah, I'd love to go get all my old dogs back and have another try just
Because that
with
you
better
actually just
skills.
touched on something that is the other thing that I also wish I could do. I wish I could also take like my puppy Zim, for example, the Malinois, and like just like in a computerized version, put him in like a regular random household and see what he would be like now. Like, did what I did actually matter? Or is this just who he is? Like, you know what I mean? Like, see what
Yes.
like my parents would have right now on their hands if they had him as a puppy and just did what they would do, you
I would
know?
love to be able to do that too. And just that was, I'm kind of in the middle of a multi-year experiment right now because I wanted to know with Wild and Crazy field type labs, why do mine, the ones that I personally keep, feel reasonably easy, and some other people have very, litter mates or closely related dogs, and they're very much a struggle. And surprisingly, it's not usually the people that get them as active pets that have the most challenges. It's people who get them as sport dogs and with big dreams and aspirations. And they're not, it's not like aggression or terrible big problems, but they're li things that are big in their world, big challenges. And you just wonder, like, what is it? Is it because my expectations are different? Is it because my dogs actually get to run off leash every day and they're not confined as much? What is it? Am I subconsciously always picking the easiest puppy when I keep my own puppy? I don't think so. I'm kind of attracted to the little rat bastards, but you think that that would be really a cool thing to be able to know, like what this specific dog would do in another situation. And how that shapes them throughout their lives. It's yeah, would
What
be
are
cool.
those? So, like, could you give an example of what some of those behaviors might be or the issues that people are dealing with? I'm kind of curious.
Yeah, so they're often related specifically to their sports work. So if somebody gets a dog for agility and they're they raise them as a future agility star for right from the start, one of the common problems is just general over-arousal. So like barking or being really having a really hard time getting a stay or those sort of control behaviors because the dog has really built up a lot of arousal around the sport, or like biting at their sleeves or something at the end of the run, things like that. There's a smaller percentage of people that find that their dog doesn't settle well in their house. And almost always it's just a misunderstanding of what settling actually is. So they're trying to get their dog to settle with like a place behavior or a down stay, and the dog is just like ramping up and ramping up. It's like, I don't think that that works very well for labs in my experience anyway. They need their brain to be off in order to turn off. So we just make a few little adjustments on that, and it works really well. But it is interesting to see even some of the culture. I think this is changing too, but the culture and agility, where it used to always be that you had to get your dog really revved up before you would run them, and you get the rev for free in the field labs. You don't want to add to it. So just teaching, even teaching people like, don't, you're calming them down a little bit. You need the thinking part of their brain, not the reacting part of their brain turn on. So those are some of the things that I would say are the most common.
Do you think also, because you did say it before a little bit, like, do you think also, or you were alluding to it, do you think it's also because you kind of know what to expect in some way where some people, like you have a lot of labs and you've bred for a long time, so you know what you're looking for. You've probably seen so many of these things, and you're just like in your sleep, you're like, I know how to address this now. And I find, and interestingly, of all the working line dogs, the Labrador is the one I see the most of. You know that. I mean, you've seen some of my posts over time, and I find there are certain behaviors that kind of pop up, and people either think it's cute when they're small and they think they'll outgrow it, and then or, and I'm and this is not a Labrador thing, I'm just saying it as a general thing, and then obviously it gets worse in some cases or most cases, especially with like those active dogs. So do you
Yeah.
think that is some of why maybe you're not having those issues where other people might be?
Totally. That's kind of the same thing that Vinny was saying. Like once you have enough experience, you go back and you would do things differently. But the average person raises like one puppy every 5 years. So even people who are like brilliant trainers, that's you're going through this so infrequently with your own dogs, right? I'm lucky in a way that I'm training like multiple puppies every year to a certain age. So I get that experience. But the other thing that you get when you do it a lot is less panic about everything. So like little things just don't bother me. And when they don't bother you, they don't become a bigger thing. You know how sometimes you can make a problem worse by like hyper focusing on it. And if you're like, oh yeah, all puppies do that, and then 2 weeks later nobody's done anything and that puppy's not doing it anymore, and like, wow, magic, right? And there's probably a little part of you that has also sort of, without even thinking about it, not done anything to reinforce that problem behavior. So you are shaping it, but you're just not worried about it so much, and that's half of it.
I can't remember what you said before. It was something you and Vinny were talking about, and it made me think about epigenetics a little bit. And I am not someone who knows like about that stuff, so I'm not like pretending that I know stuff.
Throwing the big words around now.
Damn, I was caught. But I know like some people describe it basically, and maybe I'm gonna fuck it up and I'm totally off, like way off, and I'll just whatever. But a lot of people say it's something like basically something that's passed down almost over time. Like I remember when I did my first ever agility lesson, And my coach Stephanie took the tunnel out and he just ran right through it. And she was like, oh my God, like I've never really seen it that way before. And I've trained a lot of dogs. And it was kind of funny because I didn't know at that time, that was like 6 years ago. I didn't know at that time really anything about any of that stuff. And looking back at it over time, I wonder, was that something that was passed down from generation to generation, like the idea of doing agility versus my dog Quest, who is from more like actual farm dogs, and she could care less. She actually hates agility. It has no interest. It's like she looks at it and is like, what is this? And so I just was thinking about, you've bred for so long, so do you have you seen it? Like, is this true? Have you seen that with your own dogs? Or
So I don't know specifically if epigenetics would work in that way, but it's definitely something I've thought about. Like if you were doing like a lot of weave training with both parent dogs, are there little genetic switches that flip that make weave training easier with the next generation? Maybe it's potentially one reason why things get better in each generation generally, if you're selecting dogs
yeah.
who come from pedigrees who do those things. So maybe that could totally be a possibility.
It made me just think, I think because Vinny, like what Vinny was saying before about the comparison of his dog's downstay, of Zim's downstay versus Baloo's downstay, and how easy it was. So it just makes me sometimes think a little bit about that. Because, like with Journey, agility, like, it was pretty easy in many respects. Like my coach always says, like he's the perfect first agility dog because he's not too much, but he enjoys it and he's good at it. And it's easy for someone to be able to learn because he's honest about it in many ways. But then I've worked with other people's dogs, like I've run other people's dogs in the past, and it's just like it's interesting the difference in the feel of it, if that makes sense. So I just,
Totally.
yeah, I wonder like if those things that over time are like passed, are they passed down where it makes it easier? Like instinct, I mean, I guess.
I think it's totally possible, and it would be really cool to find somebody who could study that specifically so that you would know. There are so many little behaviors that definitely have some sort of genetic component. Like we keep in really close touch with all of our puppy families, and it is insanely cool and surprising even still that you'll think, oh, well, this dog, he's the only, I've got 12 labs and he's the only one that sucks on his teddy bear. And then five of people who have his puppy say, well, my dog sucks on their teddy bear and my dog sucks on their teddy bear. And you're like, what a weird thing. And things like spinning in circles is genetic, or obviously, like, I think this is a common one, but dogs who bark more have puppies who bark more. And that one maybe isn't so surprising, but some of the other little ones, dogs who use their paws to ask in versus dogs who bounce to ask in versus dogs who bark to ask in. It's like you can follow that right through the pedigree. So there's so many cool little behaviors that come into, those family lines that it would be kind of tricky to tease it all out, but it's very interesting.
Do your dogs have, do you find that your dogs have something particular that they are better at? Like I know because you do a lot of stuff. So do you find that their breeding is there's something like that's a real strength for them? I'm just kind of curious.
So one of the things that I value in labs and I try to keep strong throughout is that they're good at everything. Like maybe not the very, very best at anything, but very good at a lot of things. So like scent type work. So there's, like Julie mentioned, there's lots doing nose work, but we're really proud of our search and rescue dogs. So when I'm evaluating my breeding dogs, I'm watching, I don't do search and rescue, but I kind of know how they work. It's not insanely different from some of the hunting type stuff that we do. And I can watch for those traits. And you can see that some dogs are stronger at it than others. Some dogs are better at staying, naturally staying close. Like you don't have to teach them a recall. They just stay in range. And others, well, you're going to spend some time on a leash or something because they're going to run away otherwise. So there's definitely like some that are stronger at specific things than others. And when we are planning our breedings and, you know, helping people try to decide which litter might be a good fit, those are all things that we consider too. So, you know, somebody that is never going to get their dog off leash, or if they have to work in an occupation where they have to be off leash a lot, well, I wouldn't funnel them towards a couple of our dogs who really want to run a lot and are going to make that teaching that range a lot harder. So, yeah, I think I lost the plot on the question there, but here
No,
we go.
that's fine. That's fine. So tell, like, really, I guess it's leading up to my question that I've been wanting to hear about for a while is like how you got into the sled dog stuff, and is it like, is it, are you like kind of unusual in that there's usually no Labrador teams, and is it difficult compared to since you had Huskies doing that competitively? Like, what's the difference? Like, there's, I don't know. I'm just so intrigued by it. I just find it really interesting.
Yeah. Well, so I was telling you, I grew up, my dad raised labs and stuff, and we kind of, as a family, got interested in dog sledding after we went and watched a race. And you know how things sort of spiral? You're like, well, that would be a good hobby for the labs. And then the next thing you know, well, we're racing, and then you probably should have real sled dogs. And then all of a sudden, we've got a whole kennel full of racing sled dogs. And then that kind of becomes your whole, like, all through high school and my early university days, I was really serious about sprint racing with a sled dog. So when I first started racing, I had, sorry, this little dog is pushing me around right now. I had one or two
It the
labs
red one?
that were
Is it
on
the
my
red one? Is he
team.
there?
Pardon me?
Is it the red one? Is he there?
No, no, it's one of my old girls. Yeah, I had one or two labs on my sled dog team, and it wasn't common back then. So there was everybody with their purpose-bred huskies. Alaskan huskies are kind of like a sport mix of a bunch of different things. They don't really look like what you'd expect huskies to look like, but they are, you know, specifically bred for racing and pulling and stuff. And then me with my black labs. And it was like the age-old joke where every musher would come over and say, "Well, are you going duck hunting? Are you racing or what?" But they were really good. And at that time, I was competitive, and I was often at the top, you know, in the top placements with those dogs. And things have evolved quite a lot from there now. I'm not racing competitively anymore. And a lot of the purpose-bred sprint racing dogs are now mixed with like pointers and greyhounds. So there's sort of a whole new level of speed, and they really look like not huskies now. They look like pointer mixes is what they all look like. And when like we went to just a local race a few weeks ago last month, and I always in my heart still expect people to be like, "Whoa, labs, so weird, right?" But they don't look that different from purpose-bred sled dogs anymore. So people just think I've got, you know, a very well-matched team. So it's not really the novelty it used to be. We're not competitive with the really well-bred sprint racing dogs, but they do okay in our little mountain trails, and they have a really good time. And I'm not traveling around to race anymore. So the things that I'm interested in dog sledding are more training skill stuff that I, you know, novelty skills that you can train because you don't care if you're winning or not. So,
How is it hard to like, is it hard to, I guess, teach them stuff to do, like the sledding and everything?
it's not really hard, but because they're not bred for it, which everybody who gets a lab that pulls on leash would disagree with. They think they're bred for pulling. I'd say about 60% of the ones that I've had take to it pretty naturally. They're pretty okay. And the other 40% need a lot of groundwork and have to go step by step to learn to love it. And you wouldn't, like, compared to the current sprint dogs, you would have like 0% that need step by step. You just hook them up and they go. So there is more of a learning curve for them there, but they really love it. They don't, when we hook them up and we're running with all our friends that have huskies or we're at the local race or whatever, nobody can tell by their attitude that they are not meant to do this. They are very excited. They love it so much. They do. I'm really proud of my little team when there's and their skills that they do have. They're very good at passing. They're generally very good at taking their turn commands. They're pretty composed that way for dogs who look like absolute psychos when they're on the start line with excitement. But yeah, we have a lot of fun with it. It's a good way to get out and get some conditioning on them for sure.
I was trying to teach Quest how to pull me on a bike.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, how's that been going? I haven't seen any videos
Well, I mean,
lately.
first of all, it's been cold. So, I mean,
Okay.
it's only recently finally broke. Secondly, it's questionable. It's very questionable. She was, for whatever weird reason, I only did it like 3 times. And then it just got too cold. I was just like, all right, this is waiting until like the spring. But weirdly, she would pull me on like up in one direction up the street, but if we went in the opposite direction, she wouldn't pull. I don't know. I haven't been able to figure out why yet.
Interesting.
I was
This
thinking that
is
the
an example of one of those behaviors that you don't get for free in
yes, yeah.
the
So what I was thinking is it's possible the direction she wasn't pulling me maybe is because that's usually the route that I'll put her on, like either her regular leash or her long line, and she just is wandering, sniffing. It's late at
Maybe.
night. It's in the direction of like the place I let her off leash. So I don't know but you would think that that would make her want to go in that direction more, right? So I don't know, because
Hard to say, yeah.
the opposite direction, I just couldn't figure out, like, why is she pulling me only this one way? Like, we don't go that way ever. So I don't know. It was interesting. So actually yesterday I bought a bike arm. Because really, what I'm afraid of is that I'm gonna run her over because she's 35 pounds. So, yeah, I just bought a bike arm that can at least hold her out. Let's give it a plug. It was called Bike Toe Leash. Bike Toe
Okay.
is the company name.
Is that one of the ones that kind of clips on the side?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was actually that's exactly what it is. So, I was just too nervous that because she's just so small. It's not like I'm running with the Labrador where, all right, the wheel hit you, like big deal. Like I feel like I'm gonna actually run her over.
Yes, no injuries. No, this is fun.
So
Don't
yeah,
wound your dog.
so I got a bike arm so that way she could run next to my bike. So we'll see how that
That'll
goes.
probably make things easier.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like I kind of makes me wonder about the direction and if she just has associations with that. But one of the interesting things, so when I had huskies, they would often, so when you're training sled dogs, sometimes you're using the same trail over and over and over, and then you're trying to build up your distance that you're running. So you'll use part of that trail, but you'll go a little further and turn around. And it's often really hard to get the huskies to go past a turn that they've taken before. They're very committed to repeating the same route, and they generally want to take the shortest route. Even if they love running, it's not like a sign that they don't like it. It's just their instinct is somehow to get back home as fast as possible. But the labs are opposite. So what we struggle with the labs is any turn that they know will take them back home, they don't want to do that one. So they can be perfectly accurate on all their turn cues, and then you're like, last one, let's go home. And they're like, never heard that word before. Definitely can't go that direction. And it can be frustrating, but also I find it a little hilarious just because it's so clear and consistent from generations of labs now that I've been dog sledding with. I'm like, I don't know why you guys, maybe this is
I
epigenetics.
was
I don't
just going to say that. Maybe it's epigenetics.
That might be, we might be training it in the wrong direction somehow, but it's funny. But maybe Quest is like, I'm not going home.
So yeah, well, but both ways are not going towards home. That's what's
There goes
interesting.
that theory.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. So what I was going to say, like, what do you think is, like, in your experience, like, what do you think is the reason that there's a direction, especially the direction that we're always going to the park off leash or going that way to walk the rest of town? Like, why that way, but the other way, like, she's pulling. Like, not only pulling, like, she's fucking galloping. It's hilarious. She's actually, like, full
You need to come up with a route where there's not a distinct change in direction. Like, see, try and find a circle route somehow.
Suburbs.
And go around the block a couple times. I don't
and
know.
Film it so we could see it.
Please, with a helmet cam.
No helmet. Just put the tripod on.
Yeah. To dig out my old GoPro and see if I can find that. So I guess, like, with the sledding stuff, is it something that only you do, or like with labs, or do you have other people that get labs from you that also do sled stuff?
I don't have anybody that's done sledding specifically, but there's quite a few that are doing like other types of dog powered sports. So canicross or ski joring, or where they can do with like one or two dogs. I've got quite a few of my puppy people that are doing that, and they're really good. The limitation with labs is we're not really built for hot weather type stuff. So it kind of rules out part of the summer for those sorts of sports. I find that the dogs build up so much internal heat when they're pulling that even if they're good at like agility or hunting or dock diving or whatever, when it's really, really hot out, the pulling sports, they gotta put that on the back burner for a few months while it's scorching. So,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I wanted to ask about was your shed hunting. Cause I never heard of that until you and I think like spoke for the first time or whatever. So,
yeah.
And that dog, that Labrador Enzo that you've seen videos of that I've talked to you about, he started doing some shed hunting stuff recently.
Oh, cool.
Like last week, I think he was just randomly like running around in the woods, and he came back with actually a shed. It was hilarious.
That's awesome. That's how I found my first one. We were out hiking or something, and the dog all of a sudden came. He's like, "Here's a moose antler," and I was like, "This is a pretty incredible prize." And I got home and Googled it, and I was like, "Oh my god! Like, this is a thing people do for fun, is they go looking for antlers." And then like, there's a whole new obsession. Okay.
How big is wait? So, because I mean, I'm only picturing what I see on TV. Like a moose antler to me, it's like 10 feet fucking long. So how big are
kind
these
TV shows are you watching?
There's some pretty big ones out there, but a lot of them, like not all moose live to be big enough like that. So a lot of the ones we find are more like a foot and a half, or you know, sign of sort of in that. They're not really overly difficult for the dogs to carry around. You could totally find. I've seen lots of people finding the really big ones, but I think you gotta. In this area, you'd have to go pretty up high into the mountains, and I don't have all that kind of time for it. So, sticking to the lowlands.
How do you, I guess, like, I don't want you to like have to give everything away because I know you have a Fenzi course on shed hunting, but like, how, I guess, do you teach something like that? Is it sort of like scent work, or is it something very different?
There's a lot of similarity. So the first thing we do is like, it's actually not overly difficult. So first thing is getting the dog retrieving the antler. So that's often the hard part for most dogs, is even if they love balls and stuff, they find that a little awkward. Once they're retrieving the antler, then you're just making it gradually more difficult to find. So I kind of like systematically build it up so that when like what I teach in the course is all the concepts that you would need if you wanted to do shed antler trialing or that sort of things. But it's really not hard to get started with. Just toss it in long grass, hide it behind the bushes, build up the searching that way. Once they know what they're looking for, and they know how to retrieve it. So the biggest difference between shed antler hunting and any other type of scent work is that they have to bring it back to you.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they don't.
Here's a dumb question, or a dumb person asking a question. How do they know that it's a shed versus like just an actual antler, like on a live animal?
Well, if one of them runs away.
Well, that was going to be my second part of the question is like, given that we've been joking about like dogs that are wild and Labradors being sometimes difficult, do you ever get one that's like, hell yeah, like I like the
you
fact
know,
that one's moving, and
that's
I
actually a
really
good
like the
question.
challenge.
He's like,
Like,
oh, you
challenge accepted, motherfucker. I'm gonna go find that
you gotta have really fast dogs.
one.
Well, so generally when we're shed antler hunting, I don't actually want to see any live animals for the risk of chasing. It just complicates things. Even if they're obedient, you just don't want to have it happen. So when I'm out there, I have a bell on the dogs, and that pretty much makes all the wildlife in the land disappear. So you don't every once in a while you'll catch a glimpse of something in the distance, but also the time of year when we're looking, they've generally already all fallen off. So
Okay,
I
that
don't
makes
know
sense.
if the dogs actually that would be really interesting to be able to see into their brains, and when they see a deer, think, oh my God, it's like a portable antler carrier thing. Or if they
Well,
just
or sometimes there's like a
think.
dead animal, like I've seen, like even like a head, like a full head. So I didn't know if like at a higher level, are you like teaching the dogs to distinguish, like there's a
No.
rotting head attached to that one. Don't Anthony always getting
So
the
don't be
thumbs down?
grossed out, but we actually don't mind if they find the rotting head ones
Oh, it's
because
the fresh one, huh?
you're like, this is so cool. So they will generally find the antlers that are still attached to a corpse. And they don't seem to be any more or less excited about those, but they find them just as easy, probably easier because there's
Yeah, fair enough.
extra
All
smells.
right. Do you have to, is it also like nose work and any like scent detection where you're having to teach each different thing? So like deer antler versus moose versus whatever else?
They do. They notice the difference between the different species for sure. The other thing is they really quickly learn to look for human-scented antlers if you're not careful. So
Oh,
if
whoa, wait, that took me a
we're
second. I was like, wait,
like
what?
the
I
like clear be handled, right?
was like,
Minnie and
what's
I
going
were
on
like,
in Canada
you
over
guys don't
there? There's
watch enough
humans like growing
cartoons.
antlers.
Minnie and I were thinking the same thing. I was like, wait, what? Wait, so you mean like because your hand touched the antler that you
That's right. Yeah.
okay.
So if you're just using your bare hands and you're hiding them and your dog is finding them, they're probably finding like Anthony scented antlers rather than antlers. And when the first time you come across one that doesn't smell like you or any human, they'll probably be like, yeah, cool, but that's not what I'm looking for. So when we're training them to find them in the wild, we're really specific about odor hygiene and being careful that we're not handling them directly. But for trials, where multiple dogs are retrieving the same antlers and stuff, we don't worry about it as much because they're going to smell like dog saliva and human hands and everything else. So, two different sort of things that you have to cover in your training if you're going to do both with the same dog.
I wonder if you ever notice your dogs, like if they notice that it's a scent of someone that they know. Like if your dogs knew me and I went to go place a hide, if when they scent that, if they start like getting happy and everything, because with Quest, she does that a lot. Like Vinny gave me a box one day and I bring the box home and I just like threw it on the bench in my kitchen and not thinking anything of
Didn't care
it.
about the present I got you, I guess.
And so Quest goes over there. Journey and her both go over there. Journey sniffs it and walks away. Quest goes over there. She sniffs it. But then all of a sudden, like I keep hearing like her feet bouncing around, her ass, like I go over, I see her ass wiggling, her tail wiggling, and I'm like, what is she doing? And so I
Yes.
realize it's the box that smells like Vinny.
Oh,
And
that's
so
pretty
this is,
cool.
but this is like a regular thing with her. So I've brought something home from the physical therapist that sometimes adjusts my dogs. And I left it down in the basement. I go down there. She goes up to it. She starts like getting all like happy, wiggling, wagging. Like this is a common thing with her. So I was just wondering if you've seen that with your dogs, because I just find that like to just be a hilarious behavior, honestly.
Yeah, that's really cute. I don't know that I've noticed it specifically with like antler hunting and stuff, but I think because they're already recognizing the odor, maybe it wouldn't be as apparent as when it's like a surprise like that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But it is interesting. So when we're out sort of in the forest hiking around looking for wild antlers, they will find and show us anything that's ever been touched by a human ever. So if there's like a beer can that you can tell has been there for 40 years, or you find all kinds of little weird things in the bushes where you think, like, I don't know how this got here. But the dogs will show you that stuff and they're like, I know that I'm not supposed to retrieve it, but you want to see this? And like, sometimes it's kind of cool stuff. So sure, I don't mind.
What's their indication for that? Like, do they just like walk over, smell it, and then they come running back to you, like going in that direction, or what are they doing?
Yeah, they don't always specifically report it because you don't reward it, right? But they kind of know. So they'll go over to the thing and they'll if they can fetch it, they might fetch it, or they'll look at you and they're like, check this out, and then they carry on looking for antlers or birds or whatever we're hunting for that day. But it's you can read their body language the same way as if you were doing scent work with your dog when you know that they're on an odor and you're trying to figure out what it is specifically. And you're like, oh, one time a dog found this little weird carved alligator toy, and I was like, I'm gonna keep that. Okay, cool. No antlers today, but I got a toy,
You
right?
got a little alligator toy,
Yeah.
that's great. There was something else. Oh, I wanted to ask you one thing that I notice. First of all, why, and this is a Labrador thing specifically that I have seen, why is it that field bred Labrador breeders have no problem giving the average family one of their dogs when they don't like these people don't realize that it's a field bred dog half the time? So I know why the public wants them. Like, I know why that is, but I'm curious why the breeder is like, yeah, sure, here you go.
Yep. Well, I can't speak for all breeders, but I think that
No,
probably it's the
speak for
same in
all of them. Tell me
all
what you really
breeds where there's a range of people and like breeding processes vary, right? So some people will have a lot of hoops to jump through and you can't get one unless XYZ, and other people will be like, if you've got the purchase price, here's your puppy. So I find that within the community of working sporting dogs in general, there's still lots of people who feel like if you want to purchase a dog, you should be allowed to purchase it and you get all the rights with it. There's nobody withholds breeding rights or whatever. I think it's starting to be a little less common as breeders are held more responsible for placements that don't work out as well. But it's still pretty widespread, and I think it's just the culture, right? Like you do your research beforehand, and if you say you want it, I guess you get one kind of thing. I don't know. It's yeah.
Yeah,
It
because
is weird that there's still not very many people in the general public that know the difference between. To me, it's weird because I've been in it my whole life, I guess, but it's like weird to think that people don't know that there's a difference between like a show lab and a field lab. If I'm on one of those pet pages, where you go to kill your will to live on Facebook,
oh,
all the people are like,
yes.
what do you think my dog is? Is he American or English? And I'm like, well, the wrong time to ask that question is now that he's 4 years old. It's like, what do you want to get with that information? I can't help you anymore. But
Yeah.
it just feels weird to not have that be widespread information, I guess.
Yeah, like I don't know. I guess 'cause I think part of why I see so many of them is because people just end up purchasing them from a breeder, that breeder, this breeder, whatever, and they don't. And they call me not even for training. They're really calling me because, hey, I have problems with my dog. He's destroying my home, or he's doing this, doing that. And then I go there, and half the time you can tell by the look that this dog physically looks different than just your average, like, lazy pet Labrador. Nothing wrong with those dogs, by the way, just saying. Like, there's just a difference in the look. And yeah, and then when I get there and I find out like how little they're doing with their dog, mentally, physically, et cetera, it's like, okay, well, that makes sense. I mean, look at what you have here. And I guess that like people, but it surprises me how people don't know. Sometimes some of them will say, Yeah, the dog has, you have to really go fishing, I find, for the information. Like I could ask them, is the dog a field bred lab or a working line Labrador? And they'll say no. And then as I start asking them more questions as time goes on, magically all of a sudden they'll surprise me with, oh yeah, the parents were this, or you, or titled in this sport or that sport. And then it's like, okay, well, hate to break the
Mystery
news.
solved. Yeah.
Yeah.
Breeder's website has dogs with like ducks hanging out of their mouth with like blood on the dog, like camo vest, and you're like, oh shit.
It's so funny.
Dad's name is like Remington the third. Skeet Shooter, Skeet Shooter the second, Vom Wulmstein. It's like, oh shit.
I was
It's
about to launch into this big
like
speech about how visually it's really hard to tell a field bred lab from just like a pet type lines at times, because if you're not, if breeders aren't specifically breeding for show type, sort of the classically overdone looks, then it kind of, the labs kind of just tend to moderate into that more athletic, leggy looking self. However, when you mentioned, Anthony, that you're able to tease the information out of them that yes, they did in fact come from a field bred line. Well, there, that solves that mystery. That's where they're coming from. Around here, we don't see, like, there's not very many other people breeding field dogs. So most of the puppies that myself and the other few breeders are producing are going into like working type homes, or people who know what they're getting anyway. Like I still sell quite a few puppies to pet homes, but they're not the people who are surprised that they're busy. Let's put it that way. They know what they want and they're active people. But it would be really hard to just come by one by accident, because there's more people looking for working type labs than there are working type lab puppies available. But that's, and it's not that way in all areas. So it's totally possible that there are, especially if you're seeing lots in your area, that there's like a culture of breeders in that area that are like, whoever wants one gets one, and it's business for Mr. De Marinis.
Yeah. Or a series says D Marinis. Yeah.
Marinis.
Yeah, because
Oh,
I
sorry.
just find, yeah, I don't know. I always find it very interesting, because I understand that the owner's not going to always realize or understand that there's a difference until they're actually living with the dog themselves. I just find it interesting. And listen, the reality is too, the breeder in their head's probably like, I'm used to this, like kind of what you were saying before, like you're used to
Right.
some of the stuff, so it's normal for you. Like when people's like, I don't know, it's normal for me with my dogs. I know that they're energetic and everything, but I do a lot of stuff with them and tinker around with them and just keep busy, so to me it's normal. And like they're both in here now sleeping, like I don't know, it's just in for me it's normal. So I understand for the from the pet home. I just find it so fascinating that it's the breed I see the most of, and people are generally pretty shocked when you say, oh, actually, this is what your dog is a lot of the time. And it's funny,
I
I just
think.
wanted to say the comment Vinny was saying before, right? You go on their website and Remington the third, whatever, like what's so funny about it is I've done this. I actually forgot until he made that comment. Like I asked one or two of those clients to give me the name of the breeder, and I'll look them up, and I go on the site and I'm like, oh my God, like, or on their Facebook page. And it's
This
just
is not a secret.
they're like, they have the
Guy's
gunner,
wearing like a ghillie suit.
the gunner kennel in the back of the pickup truck. The fucking birds are all laid out, sprawled out. Like we're gonna have a big duck dinner tonight. It's like, what the hell? Like this is not, like, this is not what you think it is. I'm sorry. Like, look at this guy's website.
I think that it's, yeah, that's kind of, it's hard to miss the signs if you're actually looking for them. As a breeder, I think sometimes it can be easy for people to not know what they want to such a degree that you have to actually, like, you have to help them figure out what they want, and the breeder has to be willing and able to do that too, right? So, like, for example, I often get people on my application form, and one of the questions I ask is if they've ever met a dog from my breeding program before, because if they have, then I at least know they have like some, they've had some experience with this type of dog. And if they haven't, then I have a whole much another list of questions that I want to go to, because I want to make sure that they know what they're asking for and what they're getting into. And one of my red flag comments when people have on their application form is they're looking for a dog that's really calm. And it doesn't matter how they finish that sentence, but I just want to know what that means to them, because it means such different things to different people. Some people, to them, a calm dog means one that doesn't have separation anxiety, or one that isn't, terrified of thunder or fireworks or whatever. And other people, it means a dog that never moves for any reason, is never excitable at all. Like, there's a just a huge range of things that people mean. So I'm like, we got to talk about this word choice and what does it mean to you, right? So there's that, and there's also a whole bunch of people who describe themselves as like being very active and outdoorsy, and it doesn't mean the same thing to everybody either, and that's totally fine. There's actually lots of labs to suit kind of almost every household. That's one of the reasons that's such a popular breed. But you kind of, as a breeder, you have to make sure you're speaking the same language, right? Because like the person who literally is training for marathons is very different active and outdoorsy than the person who likes to walk for 15 minutes before work 3 days a week. So just figuring that part out sometimes takes a lot more time than you think, even with people who seem to have expressed a big interest in the breed and seem like they've done some research, and even people who've owned many labs before in the past, because they're not all the same. Like, there's if all the dogs you've had before were really chill, totally fine with 8 hours a day and nobody's around, and they just nap even once you got home from work, well, this would be a rude awakening for you to not to realize that there's a whole nother level that's happening here. So, and it's on purpose. We're breeding them that way on purpose. It's not an accident.
Do you guys think sometimes that I'm going to try to explain this and ask this question without going off on the rails, but that trainers sometimes add to this confusion? I sometimes see this almost sometimes from the same sources of simultaneously promoting this idea of like breed doesn't matter, like it's not like you, and it's more often when it's from this type of a person I'm thinking about, it's like when a specific breed might maybe have a quality that is not is frowned upon, like aggression. Breed doesn't matter. But then simultaneously they will respond to someone with a working lion Labrador that's having a hard time with like, I don't know, my dog has arousal problems. And they'll be like, oh, but like, I trained my grandma's lab to be calm all day. But like that lab was an English lab that was maybe bred to be like a service dog. So it's like it's almost like they get the ben like they take the what is it like they eat their cake and they eat it, or they want their cake and they eat it too. It's like on the one hand, they're like, breed doesn't matter at all. But then when it suits the narrative of like, well, like my Malinois is really calm. Like I can do that without having, you know what I mean? Whatever, without having to do X, Y, Z. But then they're leaving out the fact that like maybe they have a show lion Malinois and it's not the same as the one that was like imported from Belgium and like jumps out of helicopters. So I feel like I can't really speak on that as much because I'm not a breeder. And I don't know like my own biases, but I'm wondering like from your point of view with someone that like you said you're seeing these whether it's epigenetics or you're seeing similarities even amongst the lines when you see these kind of things out on the internets, what you kind of think about.
Yeah, all of it.
All right, that's
I
that was
know. It's
that.
the end. No, you're right. There is like a whole narrative that like if you just would have trained it better from the beginning, it would have done this or that. It would have, it would have changed everything. And no, not always. And the differences between the breeds and the breed lines within the breeds are a real thing, and they do make a difference. It's I don't think there's any question that those two things, kind of play against each other, but you hear them both. I will say that there's the thing as from the breeder perspective, the thing that can we vent? This is a venting podcast.
Yeah,
Go
we've
ahead.
reached that part. We're assuming the people that
You've
completely hate
listened
us
to
have
us. We
already
tuned out
stopped
45
listening.
minutes ago. We're
Yeah,
good. Okay.
you've listened to this podcast before. You know the real deal.
So the thing that annoys me is if a trainer has met one dog of a breed or a breeding program, and then they believe that they've known all of them. So there's like you can get widespread like opinions or feedback about like for my own breeding program, I've got some puppies from one litter that are very noisy when they especially when they do agility. They are I can hear them when they get to a big event. They're very good at agility, so I get to watch them on the live streams a lot. But when I'm watching and in from another room, I can hear when one of my puppies that I bred is waiting in line because they're that noisy. So I never miss the runs. That's great. I find that level of barking irritating. However, they are also not like that 24 hours a day. It's confined to that scenario when they're very aroused. The people who got them specifically knowing that they were going to be noisy, but they wanted that level of talent and it was fine. Everybody's happy with them. But there's some trainers who've only met those particular Aramet labs who are like, oh my God, they're so loud. And there's like, actually, most of them don't bark hardly at all. But those ones are ridiculous. They're not all the same, even within the breeding program. So, like, I feel that I've probably got some biases about other breeds based on having met one or two dogs from those breeds where I'm like, holy, I cannot live with another border collie. I've fostered three of them and they all drove me nuts. And therefore, all border collies must be like that. And I can't, but obviously that can't possibly be true. I'm sure there's some that are delightful. I have an experience in my life with one beagle. I currently have one beagle. This is the only beagle that I have experience with. And he is a lot of dogs.
Oh, yeah.
When 0 to 8 months, I was like, people are nuts. Beagles are easy. This dog is awesome. And 8 months onward, I was like, I get it now. Welcome to the one and done Beagle Club. But like when you're basing your opinions or experience on like a tiny, tiny little subset of dogs, whether it's the breed or the line or the specific breeding program, you're probably just not getting the whole picture. So it's like generalizations on that kind of stuff is really hard. You have to really deal with the dog in front of you and not, I mean, learn from experiences and stuff, but you can't let your big picture be painted by like one beagle or three border collies or one very noisy Labrador.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, because I see that, and it's frustrating because, like, to your example, it would be like if I was like, oh, well, my lab is quiet, why are yours whining?
Yeah,
Like, why don't you just do what
obviously
I
those people
did?
trying to maul wrong or they're
Yeah,
or
like
the
they
horrible breeding
obviously, yeah.
program.
Yeah, actually, I just had a board and train beagle. I've had him a few times now, and he is a handful, but like amazing. Like I tell her, and these were unsuspecting people that actually rescued him, and he was rescued from a hunter. I'm sure you have some feelings on that. The rescue thought that he shouldn't be in homes where people are doing hunting. So they gave it to a family that was comparing him to the chill, easy beagle that they had in the past, and this dude is like, he's full grown and still tiny and ripped and beats up my 90-pound Malinois. Like, it is hilarious. And I've warned them, like, I think they think I'm joking, which is funny because they think I'm probably just trying to flatter them. But I'm like, your dog is more intense than my Malinois. And in a lot of ways, he really is. He's just like 20 pounds instead of 90 pounds. But I'm like, holy shit, if Zim was like this, like his food drive, his just drive for anything in general. Like, you pick up a piece of grass and start moving it, and he's like going at it. You know, like I
That's
let Zim
cool.
run in the yard and he's like tackling into him like he's like a macho man. I'm like, holy shit, dude. So
So this makes me feel better because this matches with my experience of one beagle.
yeah, he is
Okay, I didn't get the
intense.
one genetic anomaly, or I didn't train him to accidentally be saying
No,
that.
this guy is a Cooper is a little
He's
firecracker.
super
He is
fun though.
amazing. Yeah, a lot of fun.
It's interesting. It's always the rescue one too, because I have a client who has a little beagle similar to Cooper, and I haven't seen the dog in maybe a year and a half or 2 years, and then just recently I actually just started up with them again. And it's so funny to see the comparison because I still have their old beagle who was always like chill and relaxed. And then they get this dog, and I never forget when I met him, I was like, is he from like a hunter or something? Because he's like, because they were complaining about how intense he is, and he's out in the yard searching, howling, like hunting for like the rabbits and like the deer that have walked through, and he's just so loud. And then like they're like, oh yeah, he was from a hunter actually, how did you know? And I was like, oh.
There were signs. Were signs.
Surprise.
Yeah.
In the suburbs of Long Island, very good, very good.
Yeah, so that's another crazy thing. Like, where a rescue has the opportunity to place a dog like that back into its natural habitat where he could thrive, and they're like, man, no, let's put him in an apartment. Oh, that'll go well for everybody. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you ever find like that? I don't know that this happens with your dogs, but just in general, do you find that these dogs that are too intense for these certain families, I guess, are being returned to the breeder, or do you find that they're being placed a lot in the rescuer shelter, and then half the time they don't maybe place the dog in the proper home? Is that something you notice a lot or see a lot?
Just dogs in general.
More so, I think like the working line dogs or these more active dogs that are being bred for something.
Yeah, you know what? I'm not really sure. It doesn't seem to be widely discussed between breeders if dogs are like routinely being returned to them. I don't think we see all that many working type labs in rescue compared to how many are probably out there. Like, I have had some returned over the years, and like, it's not a secret that everything's worked out in the end. But it could also be because there's generally like a pretty long waiting list of people who either specifically want another rather intense dog, or they would prefer an older dog or something. So it's generally not hard to place them again if that's what's best for them when they come back to the breeder. There's been a couple times locally where we've seen dogs in rescue that's like, that dog looks like it might be a field bred dog. And through connections, we can almost always find them like a somebody in detection that will go and assess the dog and pull them out for that way. But like, reasonably well bred looking labs don't end up in rescue super often here. We get there's lots of dogs labeled as labs that aren't probably labs, or you know, the how do you get around all the breed restrictions? You call every black floppy-eared dog a lab, so
I was just gonna say, you mean like those black rescue dogs that says is a Labrador mix that looks nothing like a
yeah.
Labrador at all and has
And
chow
then
in it?
fast forward 3 months to the pet group on Facebook where they do the embark test, and they're like, oh my God, it's a pit bull. It's like, you didn't know that. Oh.
Hey man, that's why don't do the embark test. It's a lab mix. That's my legal advice.
Legal
They're
advice is some you
fucking
just don't,
tricking you.
yeah,
The
they're
embark
not
test is
allowed.
the
Vinny BSQ over here is
don't
legal.
do it. Don't do
I had a when I was at my herding instructor one time, he said, yeah, I got a text message from someone in town who just adopted a border collie mix. So they want to come do herding lessons. So he's like, I scheduled the appointment. And then he goes, I get a text message from them like a couple days before saying how excited they are. And they send me a photo of the dog. It was a black and white pit bull. It was so funny. I mean, because it was like this doesn't even remotely look like a border collie at all. I'm sorry. Like, and you know, even though it's funny, it's like, hey, like I know the people didn't know any better, but at the same time, that's so dangerous for the livestock.
Right? Oh, like any I know why the rescues do it. But it's that doesn't make it ethical, and it sometimes it's so obvious. It just I feel like a bit embarrassed for the people who adopt a dog thinking they're getting some sort of mix of a breed they've researched or decided would be appropriate, and then you're like, well, Here's some news. We're not going to be doing any herding today.
I
Or sign this waiver.
my one of my first dogs, Gerber, was a he so I did the embark test. He was a pit bull, beagle, rat terrier mix, and
Oh my God, that's a nightmare.
he was well, he was a nightmare, that's for sure. But he was like 50 pounds of intensity, this dog. And I never forget, I worked at the shelter for like a year, and he was one of the main dogs I was working with for that year. His breed on his cage card on the floor changed 5 times in a year before I took him home, because they were just trying to like sell him,
Yeah.
and they just like kept changing the breed
You
each.
don't know anyway, so let's try
Like, I don't even get it. Like, what's the, I mean, I guess like from a selling standpoint for them to like get rid of the dog and make space for something else to come in. But really, at the end of the day, I would say the majority of the time at a shelter, when people go there, like, who gives a shit, really? Like, most of the people are walking on the floor and they're like, oh, that one's cute, I want that one. And then they're like, no, you don't want that one, that one bites. No, I like that one, that one's cute. So it's like, sometimes it's kind of like, what's the point of putting the breed on the card anyway?
I don't know,
I love how now
do you
some
think people
shelters are
don't
just like
care?
leaning in hard. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Vinny.
I love how some shelters are just like leaning in hard the other way. Like, it'll be like the most wild mix. Like, this is a Pit Bull, Malinois, Rottweiler mix. And then you see the picture and it's like definitely just a lab mix then. Like, they're just like going the other way. You're like, oh, damn. And then like you go to the owner's house and like, yeah, he's going to be huge one day. And it's already like 5 months old. It's like 15 pounds. And you're like, yeah, I don't think it's going to be what you think it's going to be, dude. It's so funny.
The Zillow, what's that hairless dog breed? You get mixes like that on the car where the dog is like fully haired and nothing
Yeah.
like it. They're just like, this is very exotic. Maybe somebody will adopt it now.
No.
I don't know
That's
though,
funny.
Anthony. Like when I talk to people, I haven't worked in a shelter for a few years, so it might be different now. But I feel like the breed still matters, even if people don't know for sure. I think they still consider it or make decisions on it, because they certainly talk about it after they adopt a dog anyway,
Yeah.
even if they don't know.
I
So I
feel,
wonder.
but like part of me, so I agree with you, but I think part of me feels that that's almost the after the fact part.
Could be.
Like, I think like a lot, I've seen so many people where they get the dog because they're like, oh, it's cute, and they don't realize, and this goes back to our conversation earlier, they don't realize, oh shit, that's like a working line Labrador or whatever. Like, they just were like, oh, that's cute, whatever that thing is there. And then it's like, whoa, that thing is a freaking like little ticking time bomb of like energy, and they don't realize that at all. And then I do think that the breed thing kind of, I feel like it kind of matters more after the dog is adopted, when they're telling everyone about the dog and they're, showing off their newly adopted dog, you know what I'm saying? Like,
You know what? You're probably
unless
right. You're probably right, because what we see in this area right now, which is for the last few years, is just an abundance of livestock guardian mixes, and they are hella cute when they are puppies, and they are in need of serious help by the time they're like 8 or 9 months old, pretty consistently, and they're not so cute anymore. And people are like, "What do you mean it's supposed to bite strangers when they come on my property?" Oh no, you didn't know that?
It's so
That's
funny
bad
because I
news.
didn't, I wasn't saying the breed, but as I was saying it, I was talking about it. That's what I was thinking in my head, because I've seen so many of those come through. Like, I've just seen so many of like those guard dog type breeds.
Yeah.
And yeah, they're adorable when they're fluffy and small, and then all of a sudden that puppy's head is the size of its body when they adopted it, and now it's like 10 times the size, you know?
Yep. I don't know. There seems to be some people who have really good experiences with them as family dogs and pets. But I have not yet seen it in real life, and I wonder if it's just
In
the
real
gene pool that's in this area. I mean, I like there's different like people. They maybe they're going to really responsible breeders and getting really well-bred dogs, or maybe they know what they're doing and they're putting in the extra socialization. But on the average person around here, it's not working out so well. So
We need
it's a
someone to start
struggle.
cutting some friendly Labrador into that livestock guardian.
Oh, they mix them with
Yeah,
everything. So maybe that's the way to go.
don't. I was gonna say, don't even joke because I bet you that's happening. Like I've seen like breeding on purpose with Pyrenees and Heeler mix. Oof.
Oh no.
Yeah,
Oh
oof. Yeah,
no. What does
oof
that
is
look like?
right. Oh, what did it look like? I mean,
Yeah.
well, it looked like a guard dog for sure, but that personality was really interesting. It was like definitely, you could see there was definitely a mix there of like
Yeah.
intensity and the guard dog in there. Yeah. And obviously, what a surprise, like resource guarding at like a super young age. Surprise.
Very, very good at
I wanted to ask you, since you brought up the responsible breeder thing, I just wanted to ask you about that. So we had one of our friends on here that spoke about like ethical sheltering and stuff like that. She's going to listen to this episode now, I think, Finney, and be like, what are you talking about those shelter dogs? So like, what do you feel is, do you have an opinion on like responsible breeding? What does that look like? Is it just for the structure of the dog? Is it for the temperament? Is it for placing the dog in the right home? Like what, if you have, I imagine you have opinions on this. So like, what does all that look like? What is a responsible breeder or breeder program looking like?
Yeah, this is so earlier Vinny said like sometimes he has an opinion and the next day he has a different opinion. And this is one of those topics where I think that
I was
there's
saying
like
that before we started recording. Or is this a repeat that
okay,
knock?
well, you made it this far on the podcast, now you know the
I didn't mean
truth.
that
Wow, he wow, I mean that was only like 1 hour and 15 minutes ago.
I'm a
Wow.
different
Different person
hour,
now.
not day by day.
I'm a
Okay. Oh, yeah, I
different
was gonna say
person.
it's not day by day.
So I guess in response to your question, like I think there's a like a more of a spectrum on responsible breeding versus like boxes you can fit in. So for me, important ones are that the breeder's actually being responsible for the puppies that they produce. So placing them as well as they can and being willing to take them back at any time in their lives. So if you have a placement that doesn't work out, people make mistakes, lives change, things happen. That puppy sh ideally doesn't become a burden on the shelter system. So that's like my number one above all else, I think. And then being proactive on things like health and temperament. So is the breeder doing a breed appropriate health test? And not only that, because it's pretty easy to do testing nowadays, are they also like investigating the things you can't test for, like epilepsy or cancer or cruciate injuries or all those sorts of things? Because you can't prevent them with the simple test, but maybe you don't breed like two family lines that are strong in those problems together, and like try and reduce the odds a little bit. And similar things for temperament, like what is the breed meant to be? Because what is appropriate for a livestock guardian dog is not necessarily an ideal Labrador temperament, and people should be able to reasonably expect, like, you should get a lab puppy if you would like a dog that is people friendly. You should be able to reasonably expect that the breeder has worked to produce that kind of dog, and other similar temperament traits, whatever goes along with the breed too. So doing those sorts of things is important, and I think just generally standing behind your dog. So if you get a puppy from a breeder and you've got a question, you should be able to call them up and ask that question, and they're not going to know every answer, but maybe they have connections that can help, point you in the right direction. So part of puppy from a responsible breeder to me means you've got like one other person that's on your team for the life of that dog that can help make it successful in whatever form or shape that takes, that part will vary, but those are, I think, kind of the big ones for me.
Yeah, I remember when I picked Quest up, I remember her breeder, who I knew, he was a coach of mine with Journey with Herding, and he said owning a dog is like dating. So he's like, at any point, if it's not working out, send the dog back. You
That's,
know, and
yeah,
I,
that's perfect, right?
yeah, and I think that's so important that, like, I think that's so important because I sometimes think about not even purpose-bred dogs like what you're necessarily breeding, but more for the average pet home. And I feel like there needs to be like a list of questions that the breeder should be asking that family, but then also a list of questions that family should be asking the breeder too. So that way, like, hey, you know what you're getting? Because the thing is like so many, and this is again why I was saying before, I see so many working Labradors and they're placed in these homes that maybe they're really, I don't want to say they're not meant for, but it's that the family wasn't expecting some of that. And I just think if they were doing a little more research and exploring that a little bit more, they would maybe have some of those answers. I mean, I'm sure like you probably see it with like service dogs and people reaching out for, I don't know if they're reaching out to you, but I've seen that where people will get a Labrador and they want to train it to be their service dog. And it's like, yeah, but this is a field bred lab. Like, this is way more intensity. There's going to be things that like you're not going to be able to bypass here versus like that
Yeah.
type of dog who's bred to just kind of do the tasks, hang around, be pretty chill, be on like on point, on time for their person, you know.
Yep, I definitely get those inquiries, and it is a struggle because those are the people you would love to be able to help on one way, but I don't, for me personally, sticking them with a dog that is gonna take until they're 8 years old to mature enough to be responsible in public is probably not a very good way to help them. And it kind of sucks because the people who, lots of times, the people reach out to you, or like people who reach out to me as a breeder, are really good people. And I think they would be amazing owners and I'd love to help them, but I know my dog is not likely to be the best fit. And they're like, but we really want a puppy from you. And I'm like, well, I really would like you to have a puppy, but if this isn't gonna work out. So being okay with being the bearer of bad news is part of the job. And it's one of the crappier parts of it is just saying like, no, I can't. And they're like, what about you send me the quietest one in the litter. I'm like, well, I'm still not trying to make that type of dog. So even if that happened, by the time we realized it, you would have found a better placement somewhere else. It's just the odds are very low. So don't wait around for that unicorn puppy. That's probably not going to happen. And it's part of the job, recognizing that not every puppy is a good fit for every home, even if you really like the home a lot.
Yeah, no, that
Yeah.
makes sense.
My vet asked me once, she said, Erin, would you ever place a puppy with me? And we were in probably just some major favor or emergency she'd done for me or something. And I was like, oh no, why would you ask me that? And she said, you wouldn't, would you? And I was like, no. And she said, good. That's what I was saying. You can't just sell the puppy to anyone. I definitely wasn't planning to sell her a puppy, but I'm like saying it right in the middle of this question. Like, why would you put me on the spot like that?
I know, I was gonna say that was a trick question right there.
Yeah. My nice answer is usually I don't have a puppy available right now. So,
Oh,
That's
that's
why
a
it's
good
a
spot.
shame. It's such a shame that breeders are vilified. And I'm gonna do what I did before. I feel like there's nothing wrong with this, but there's a large group of people that are very concerned with the emotional state of dogs, with the health of dogs, with the well-being of dogs, how they're treated, making sure they're in the right homes. And then it's like, damn, you know, like, there's a really good solution to that. Like, this thing, like, imagine we had this group of people that like tracked dogs over time and like looked for emotional stability and like health stability, and then really knew their dogs, and then only placed them in homes that they knew those dogs would thrive. Like, we should invent that type of person. Like, that'd be great. Oh wait, like that's exactly what every like the same people. And again, like this is why I'm not doing this to pick on anyone, because like those are all honorable things to care about. Like, but then it's like, boom, there's this huge solution right here. And like, I know it's a bigger can of worms. Like, I'm simplifying it. And look, like I have a rescue dog. Some of the best dogs that I've trained and I've met have been just rescue mutts that just like they're great
Just
dogs. So like
great
I'm
dogs.
not trying to do that, but like it, to also lump you in the same category as like some guy that's like selling 30 puppies on Craigslist, you know, for like $150. And like it's like he bred the dog because like he liked the one that he had, or like he found one roaming in the street. It's just like crazy to lump you in with that. Where like, yeah, that I think is terrible. Like I almost wish like it, like if I was the leader of the world, it would be like if you backyard bred in a bad way, it should be like the worst penalty ever, like 50 years in jail. Like you're just done. Like I know it's not gonna happen. But then if you're a breeder, like it's like you could make like $500,000 a year. You know, like you know, like I know we can't do this, but
Vote
like
Vinny, everybody, vote
my dogs are 150 grand a pop. No, I'm kidding. No, but you know what I mean? Because it's like so frustrating. It's like, damn, like you are the answer to the problem of like a lot of like what a lot of people are dealing with. Like I see so many people are dealing with like 3-year-old dogs with like crazy health problems. Like, and like, look, I know stuff happens, but like a lot of it, like it's like so prevalent in specific communities of people, of like types of, I guess, trainers or groups, whatever you want to call it. And they're dealing with that, or like even emotional, like I feel like so many dogs like have like are medicated and are having surgeries really young and like all this stuff. And like, sure, I know like the environment has an impact, and maybe social media or the way people are training, whatever you want to try to ascribe to it. But like, I feel like you're someone that like you're at the it's like the start of it. You're cultivating this like line, and you've like dedicated your life to it. And if there were more people that were doing what you were doing, like I don't know. That's just me.
I like where you're going with that. And listen, there's one other, I think, like little rabbit hole from there is that an additional issue with vilifying breeders is that it makes it less likely that the next person with a really sound dog will consider breeding them. So, like, there are people that have, just as a personal example, some of my puppies that I think, like, that is a really special dog. I wish you would be interested in breeding it. And they're like, oh, I don't want, it's a lot. It's a lot of hassle. It's a lot of this. But really, what it is it's, I mean, it probably is a lot of hassle and expense and risk and stuff. But it's also a lot of public pressure that unless you are willing to take that on, oh, you're one of those people that's filling the shelters up with dogs. Well, no, that's actually not what I'm doing. But that's the message that's received by people who could be starting to get into breeding and helping you produce really sound, stable dogs for family dogs or working dogs or whatever, but they just don't want to start in on that. The other thing is there is a small percentage of people who are backyard breeders that could become good breeders with a little bit of coaching or mentoring. But because the universe and society has got us set up to sort of eat our own, like you can't actually associate, like I couldn't associate with people who are backyard breeding to help them because then I might become lumped in with them. Or you couldn't sell a really nice dog to somebody who has already taken on the task of, breeding and try to help them do it right and learn about health testing and stuff because no one will ever sell you another dog again. And it's like the us versus them, which kind of we see in everything. It's in dog training, it's in dog breeding too, and it's a detriment to everybody in the long run because even though I would totally agree that people who are casually and intentionally breeding really shitty dogs and selling them knowing that they're going to have problems, not everybody that is breeding incorrectly is doing it intentionally. It's just that there is almost like this state of information overload. Like you couldn't Google how to be a good dog breeder and come up with any sort of helpful information. It would be so much shit. You couldn't know what to sort through, right? Like you'd have to know somebody in dogs to get better at being in dogs. And it's hard. It's a really tricky place for the world to be in right now. And that whole thing is very difficult to navigate, because even if somebody who is, this is a situation that comes up every once in a while, somebody will call or email and want to use one of my stud dogs. They give me the information about their Labrador, and it's not a dog I would be interested in breeding with because it's got a poor pedigree, or it's got, they tells me about their health problems the dog already has, or something comes up like that. And you think, well, you're already doing the right thing by looking for a good stud dog, but you just need to start with a better dog to begin with. And you can't, it's really hard to just make that leap. It's also very insulting to tell somebody that their dog isn't good enough. People take it so personally, and it's even when you're nice about it, it's very difficult.
Yeah, no, I could totally see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good insight. I appreciate that. 'Cause yeah, it is tricky.
Tell everyone where they can learn more about you. And I know you have some things coming up, so tell everyone about that stuff, any courses you got going on.
Sure, yeah. So I'm pretty active on social media, and I love to get friend requests from dog people and talk about dog stuff. So find me on Facebook or Instagram. I'm at Aramet Labs, but I've also got some courses coming up through the Fenzi Dog Sports Academy, starting in April. I don't know when this will air, but if it errors in time, maybe you'll catch those classes. I've got a dry land dock diving course coming up, as well as a shed antler hunting course. So, anybody was intrigued by human scented antlers, we can definitely talk about that in class.
And you've been
And how
in
are you spelling Aramet? Sorry, I just so people are listening.
Eromit.
Say it again. I think it got cut off.
Eromit.
Perfect.
You also have been on Fenzi Academy's podcast a bunch of times, so that's also another.
Yeah, there's some old episodes on there. Yep.
Yeah, I was
You
gonna say
bet.
it's another spot people could learn more about, like a lot of the things you do. I've listened to some of them, and you go in detail. It's not like this podcast. They're more concise and short, and they talk about one topic, unlike what Vinny and I do here. We're just like, here we are.
Oh, the rabbit holes are so entertaining. I like it.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. This was
Yeah,
great
thanks so much.
that
Yeah.
we were able to come on here.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me. That was awesome.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Canine Classroom. If you liked the show, make sure to smack that like button, share the show with your friends, and give us a rating. Until next time, class dismissed.